Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber.
This episode of Red Inca is all about Australian cricket's Night of Nights, the Alan Border Medal. For that, we get on a writer who's written a book about the award, but also looks at all the potential winners through history.
My name is Dan Lipke. My job title is I am the author of a new book called Australian Cricket's Best of the Best.
We talk about Aussie Rules Football and Rugby League, Alan Border. We talk a lot about Alan Border. Shane Warne, Russell Crowe, Belinda Clark, Elise Perry, Karen Rolton, Charles Bannerman, coverage of women's cricket, Colin Miller, Shane Watson, and what happened if Alan Border had never existed. So I've been thinking about this a lot. So you've written a whole book about the Alan Border Medal. But I was thinking about the Alan Border Medal's place in sort of culture. Is it possible that the Alan Border Medal was essentially made up because cricketers wanted a night where they could dress up?
That's pretty much my understanding of it, yes. I think just the research I did on this tends to suggest that Shane Warne, when he was, you know, part of the head of the Cricketers Association, he very much liked the idea that because he didn't quite get to qualify for a Brownlow medal, he thought, well, I'll do the next best thing. I'll create my own medal that I might win. And then, of course, tragically, he never won it. But in theory, he could have won it. So, yeah. So,
well, I mean, he went to a lot of
Shane Warne's idea.
He walked a lot. Yeah, he got to walk the red carpet, which is about 80% of what he was looking for there anyway. It should be noted, if you're in Australia, you will know this, but a lot of fans will be listening to this around the world, that Australia has a medal culture that is not particularly known around the world. So the Brownlow that you just talked about, that's the Aussie Rules one, and that's huge. You know, the Monday before the grand final was like, you know, half the country would watch that. And then, and you're going to have to correct me on this, but I know that you're a fan of the other sport, but is it the Dally M medal?
It is the Dally M, yeah. And it's not quite as insanely followed as the Brownlow. The Brownlow is like next level. Brownlow is like, you know, 10 out of 10. Dally M's like 2 out of 10. Alan Border Medal is like 0.2 out of 10.
So yeah, I think the point being is I would assume that Dally M and the Brownlow sort of come from that, whether one inspired the other, because a lot of stuff between AFL and rugby league kind of inspire each other, even if they are completely separate. But the point being is there is an element of, in Australian sport, we like to go to a big event, parade all of our athletes through the center of it, film it, make the event 18 hours longer than it needs to be. The Brownlow starts at dawn and finishes 4 days later, from what I can remember. Yes. I remember watching it with my wife once on a stream, and she was like, how is this possibly still going on? Like, you know, we've conceived a baby. We've had a baby. The second baby's on its way. We still don't know if Dusty is going to win this thing. Who's Dusty was her next question. But the point being is that already existed. And like, I don't think I'm going to have to do this one day, but the AFL's, and Aussie Rules Football in general's power over cricket, or motivation over cricket, or inspiration over cricket is huge. Like, if you went through all the different things that exist in cricket because of Aussie Rules Football, it's really high up. So this is just and that's not just in Australia. That's like the IPL final system is taken from Aussie Rules Football, right? Like, there's so many different things that you have from this. It becomes the first one. I remember it starting, and there was a little bit of excitement. Then there was about 3 or 4 years where people took it quite seriously. Then there was a bit of a dip. It seems to me in a bit of a lull, the Alan Border Medal at the moment. Where's your feelings on it?
That's pretty much my feelings as well. I think part of the excitement of those first few years was that this was an Australian side that, you know, had won, like they crushed every opposition they could. There was nothing else to compete against, so they just started competing against one another. All right, we beat everybody, so who's the best out of us? And so that was the excitement in the first few years. And then after a while, I think it became, oh, wait a sec, we're not beating everybody anymore. I mean, there's a great moment, which I cover in the book, where after the 2005 Ashes loss, everybody got the shits because Phil Tufnell came on and made, you know, a few pretty tame jokes about how bad the Australian cricket team was, and they were all fuming and upset about it. And, you know, so I think at that point it was a little bit, okay, well, what exactly are we celebrating? And then by the time you get into kind of this, you know, 2010-11 era, poor old Watto's winning back-to-back ones and no one cares, because it's just like, well, you're not the best, you're the least rubbish of the lot. So, yeah.
There's been some moments. I've got this memory, and you might have written about it in the book, but I've got this memory of like Colin Miller and Michael Slater being absolutely hammered on a table together, which is one memory. Recent ones, of course, Mitch Marsh's incredible speech. What a gift to life Mitch Marsh is every time he opens his mouth. You know, his incredible speech. You know, what are some of the other sort of more non-crickety great moments of Alan Border Medal? I'm sure there's probably been some random things that have happened that I've forgotten about now.
Well, an interesting thing is Russell Crowe played at the first one with his band, 30-odd Foot of Grunt.
He did too! I forgot that.
so that's a good one. But yeah, there's a whole heap of weird things. Like HD and Roy did like a 10-minute spiel one time. So they came up and introduced, basically it was just a tribute to Alan Border and why he was awesome in the 80s when everyone else was shithouse. So yeah, it was. There's been a whole heap of things like that, as you alluded to, Slater. I think it was the first one, maybe it was the second one, decided he'd clamber on stage while Jimmy Barnes was singing K-San, so he joined in with that. Lots of crazy antics of that kind. So I cover all those. I mean, they're not every year. So, yeah, when they show up, I give a glimpse of the actual ceremony itself. Mostly the book's about the actual cricketing performances that led to someone getting a medal draped around their head.
But you did something far more interesting, which is actually what I want to talk about here, which is you went back and you looked at the historical Alan Border medalist. Did you go back to Day Dot?
I went back to 1877. So as Day Dot as Test cricket gets.
Yes. My first question is, who has won the most Alan Border medals, according to you, Dan?
I'll give you a clue. His initials are DGB.
I thought he might have been. How many did you end up giving the great man? Is it more than 10?
I think he pretty much hogged. Well, he won in 1929, which was a surprise to me because I kind of felt, all right, he didn't burst out of the box, but apparently he did. He burst out enough to get the first one of the 20s. I basically broke down the historical ones by decade. So it was, player of the 20s, player of the 30s, player of the 40s, etc.
Oh, okay.
And I tallied how many they won in each one and whoever won the most, I just declared them the winner of the decade and then wrote about them as my kind of entry for that particular decade. So Bradman, obviously player of the 30s. I think he won all, but maybe there were two where he didn't get it. He won the other eight.
Who pipped him? Yeah. Like someone like Grimmett or O'Reilly might have got him.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was O'Reilly. And I think it was Arthur Morris might have pipped him at the post in one year. I can't remember off the top of my head. I think he also won another one in the 40s as well. So he's all over the place.
Does Bannerman win the first one?
It's not Bannerman. The first one, I cheated a bit. I said, well, I'm not going to do a player of the 1870s.
There weren't a lot of them.
I did 1870s and 1880s. So it was Spofforth, I think, who got the first one there.
Oh, that's fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I suppose with Bannerman as well, if you do the 1 year, he would probably win it. But he was absolutely rubbish outside of that one incredible innings. Like, he really becomes a terrible player. His brother,
good test to be good in, though.
Yeah, if you're going to do something, it's that great story, isn't it? Bannerman plays one test where he does anything and Ted Pooley is supposed to be the wicketkeeper for England and is in jail in New Zealand. Like, those two guys really had diverging lives based on what happened in that first test and how they were remembered. Okay, so we've got Spofforth, we've got Bradman. Is there anyone else who dominated in a way that you didn't really expect or was noticeable to you?
Mostly it was the kind of names, because I'm not as much of a historian as you are. I'm mostly just, in my lifetime, which is becoming more historical as I age. But in general, like the early 1900s, I'm not on top of that. I just know the big names. But it was pretty much all the big names came out, your Warwick Armstrongs and the like. So Victor Trumper, the usual ones back then. And because I didn't want to repeat anybody, Betty Wilson got a nod. So we covered the women as well. So that's a virtual Belinda Clark award, of course. and then obviously by the time you get to the 70s was a fascinating one because I had a rule that if players had the same number of wins in a decade, then I just chose whichever of the two players I found the cooler or more interesting to write about.
That makes sense.
Lilly and Chappell were so even throughout the 70s, Greg Chappell this is, and it was just like, oh, God, they're both pretty good. And I even thought, all right, am I going to break this tie by looking at World Series cricket? And I had a poke around at that. I was like, well, Chappell probably would have won the first year and Lilly the second, or maybe it was the other way around. I don't remember. But I looked at that. I was like, bloody hell, I can't even separate them there. And then it was just like, Lily's cooler than Chappell. Sorry, Craig. You're missing out here.
I mean, Greg Chappell is cool, but when compared to Dennis Lilly, it wouldn't feel as much, would it? Like, I think if Greg Chappell had played in the 60s, like, you know, he's Richie Benaud, right? Like, he's the guy that everyone would go on about. But by the 70s, there's a lot of chest hair and sideburns and, you know, raw masculinity and, you know, and everything. I've just been finishing a documentary series for Channel 9 on the Kerry Packer World Series cricket. And it's like, there's so much just ridiculous dripping energy. And Greg is kind of looks like he kind of looks like your favorite high school teacher in it.
He's almost English in comparison to some of those other incredibly Australian men. Like they are hairy and moustachey and he seems almost, you know, upper class. and part of that's all the way he batted as well. Like that incredibly straight, an orthodox batting style.
All right, here's my other thing I wanted to, I'm just seeing if, I want to see if I wrote this question down. No, I didn't write this question down, but I did mean to. How many Alan Border medals would Alan Border have won if Alan Border could win Alan Border medal?
I think that he was definitely the player of the 80s. I'll tell you that because there was not a lot of competition in the 80s.
Nope.
Although, what was interesting, I was quite impressed that Steve Waugh would have won one in 89. He would have also won one in 95. And then, of course, he did win one in 2001. So that's pretty good from the older Waugh to
three decades.
But yeah, AB, I think AB won a couple in the middle years where everybody else was absolutely hopeless. And then he might have also won one in the back end of the 80s, maybe 88. I think he won three in the 80s in total, which felt actually less than I would have expected, but there you go.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there were probably little flare-up moments with other cricketers who would come through at times where, you know, Bruce Reid might have had a period, Craig McDermott might have had a period, David Boone might have even had a period.
Was in there. I think even Simon O'Donnell was in there. So and a good cross-check for my methodology was for the periods where it overlapped with, remember the Benson and Hedges International Cricketer of the Year? That was kind of a good cross-check. It's like, well, most of those games are in common with the games that were used to judge the Alan Border medal. So I was just like, if they're broadly similar, that's to be expected. And Simon O'Donnell got a lot of points, won Benson and Hedges International Cricketer of the Year summer, and he similarly got a lot of points in the Alan Border medal that year. So, yeah.
What about Alan Border? That was something that, you know, you can't really write about the Alan Border medal without writing about Alan Border. What do you think? I wonder if we were naming the medal now. I just don't think Alan Border, it would be named after him now in a way that it was in 2000. That was about, what, 5 or 6 years after he retired, maybe 7 years after he retired. That was kind of the peak of, Alan Border was great. And then as the team gets really, really good and kind of surpasses everything that Alan Border did, it's interesting how much his legacy is diminished now.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. But I guess at the time he was still like he would have still been the top test run scorer at the time, I think, when in 2000. Maybe Sachin had overtaken him by then, but he was certainly Australia's number one by then.
I don't think Sachin would have gone past him by then, would he? No, he would have been on his way.
He was the number one test run scorer at the time. So, yeah, so he obviously had all these longevity stats to his name, which is always sound impressive. And, yeah, and of course, even without the longevity, like his actual stats, his batting average against the West Indies, for God's sake, he was obviously a great cricketer. But I think you're right. I think in the modern day, people will kind of look back and go, oh, yeah, he was good in the 80s. Who else was good? Oh, yeah. The Wars were good in the 90s. Warney. It'd probably be Warne today, wouldn't it, given everything that's happened?
Yeah, and also I find it interesting that they sort of skipped some of the earlier greats as well. Like it could have been – you could have had a Chappell medal, for instance. You know, Bradman is the obvious one, but I think you might have found this research. I think there was a specific reason they didn't name it after Bradman, and that was partly just because everything else in the history of mankind had been named after Bradman. And that is why Nasser Hussain decided to bowl first at the Gabba. And this all, of course, reminds me of Hit Wicket, which is a mobile cricket strategy game that is all about making those tough decisions. Who do you want to send in as an opener when the asking rate is climbing? Do you go for the big hitter or the steady accumulator? Me, I like to throw in someone a little bit unorthodox. A bit of a wild card, like the general. That keeps the opposition guessing. And what about the bowling attack? Do you unleash your express pace early or hold back for the death overs? I'm always tempted to bring on a mystery spinner in the middle overs and just try and break a partnership. Hit Wicket puts you in the captain's chair. You draft the squad and select the batting order and even decide when to use those game-changing abilities. Do you burn your 2x ability to chase down a big total or save it for a critical moment later on? It's strategic, it's addictive, and it's more nerve-wracking than facing a Shoaib Akhtar bouncer. Give it a go. Download Hit Wicket and see if you've got the tactical nous to win.
Everything's named after Bradman. Bradman, I think, had also been like the Young Cricketer of the Year award, like predating the Alan Border medal. So I think they just didn't change that. They just said, you can keep doing that. That will be the Bradman award because Bradman was young once, apparently.
They could have gone back to people like Warwick Armstrong as well, Victor Trumper. Like, you know, there were other things that they could have done. I think, and you kind of touched on it a moment ago there, I think people have forgotten how good a cricketer Alan Border was. Is that something that you kind of look at in the book?
Yeah, well, because I write a chapter on each player of the decade, it gave me a perfect opportunity to like kind of delve into, and obviously given the book's named after him, essentially. That was the chapter where I got deep into why exactly it was justified naming this award after him. He's just, you look at his record against the West Indies, there's one in series where it's basically just Border versus the West Indies, and he kind of holds them off for 3 tests in a row. He can't hold them off forever because they're the West Indies, but he holds them off longer than any one man should have been able to hold them off for. He's got like 98 not out and 100 not out in the same test. Like that's insane. So he was a great cricketer, and the fact that nobody else was there to help him for about 2 years, the way the Alan Border medal works, as you know, is that you know you get 3-2-1 points for each match, and in one of the years in the 85 or 86, it was just like Border's just getting 3 points in every match. There is no one else doing anything, so he just races out to this impossible to catch lead, and it's just like okay. Hopefully someone else shows up soon. And they did eventually. The story of Australian cricket in the 80s.
Definitely. You look at his record. So in the West Indies, he plays 10 tests and he averages 53. And he plays from 84 to 1991. So he plays against both generations of the West Indies bowlers. Yeah. And the other best lineup I would say he went up against was Pakistan, which he plays from 1980 until, when was his last test? 1988, I think, was the last time he went to Pakistan. He averages 62 in 9 tests. And he also plays against peak Hadley through the majority of his career. So those are the 3 best bowling attacks. He averages over 50 in those lineups, right? Yeah. Like, when we went through it, you would know about this, but I don't know if everyone knows about this. Do you know about the Australia home and away averages in batting?
No, fill me in. I may know what you're talking about, but give me specifics.
So there are heaps of Australian batters with a batting average above 45, let's say, but certainly above 50 compared to other countries, right? And you start to go, oh, so many great batters. And you go through them. Like, well, he averages 38 away from home and he averages 35 away from home and he averages 32. I think Warner might be 32 or 33 or something.
Yeah, Warner's rubbish away from home.
But Michael Clarke is another one. Doug Walters there's a lot of them when you go, and I'm not talking, we're talking about the ones you remember. I could go back through history and you keep seeing this pattern, right? Yeah. Bradman is one of the rare ones who made more runs away from home than he did at home. So Australian batters on Australian pitches are probably the best batters who have ever existed, right? Australian batters away doesn't always carry over. Would you like Border's record? So Border, he averages 46 in Australia, which you would take is absolutely fine. Border when traveling averages 56.57.
Yeah, that's Sangakkara-esque?
And as we just said, the three best bowling attacks he went up against, he absolutely crushed them over there. There's no massive holes within his away record. He played three tests in South Africa. At that stage, he was like 183 years old.
Yeah, very old. And
he didn't actually make a lot of runs. In I think his high score was 45. He still averages 38, though, right? Like, so it's not like he drops off. He plays four tests in Sri Lanka and he averages 48. That includes when he played Sri Lanka was when he that famous test where he plays against Murali for the first time and comes down to Ian Healy and goes, I can't pick this leg spinner at all. And Healy goes, yeah, he's an offie, mate. Second time I've told that story in 24 hours, by the way, but I love that story. You know, in England, we obviously know that England wasn't a great side when he was playing against them. But he does play 25 tests in England and he averages 65. Like he averages 53 in the West Indies. He averages 54 in Asia. And then of course, a 65 in England. So it's when we were going through our book and I had a young guy working with me called Cheyenne. He's just going, how high can we get Bradman? So how high can we get Border? All the time, how much higher can we push Border up? Because you look at it and you're like, this guy was on an incredible level. And, you know, in my list of top 50 batters, he's on the same level as Greg Chappell and as Ricky Ponting, right?
Yeah.
But that is not how he's talked about in Australian cricket, other than the West Indies stuff, which we do hype up. And I think the biggest issue is that Alan Border is known as a captain, not as a batter. And people have forgotten just how good he was with the bat in his hand.
Yeah, that's probably right. Yeah, he's I primarily, because Border was the captain for pretty much since I can remember first watching cricket until whenever he gave it up, 93 or whatever. So that's basically my entire childhood and early cricket watching. And I remember how it was completely discombobulating when he disappeared. It's just like, wait a sec, who the hell is this fat bloody slip captaining the team? I don't want him. Where's AB? Give me my AB back. But yeah, so he became such a, like, he was just always there. You couldn't imagine anybody else captaining Australia for a long time. And no wonder he's kind of entrenched in everyone's mind as a captain rather than a player, because that's all he was for so long.
I've got this question for you. You might even talk about it in the book, but I'd be very interested. Where do you think Australian cricket goes if Border, I don't know, what other sport could Border have played? Hockey. Oh, no, he's left-handed. It can't be hockey, can he? They're bad.
Baseball. Baseball, remember hearing 1,000 times that he had a great baseball career ahead of him.
You're right. He was baseball, wasn't he? Let's say he got picked up for the major leagues and him and Dave Neilson are playing for the Brewers and other teams of names which I've forgotten at the moment. What do you think happens to Australian cricket? Because I think professionalism was coming anyway. Bob Simpson was obviously a huge part in changing the way that Australians prepared for cricket. There was the whole Institute of Sport thing. But I wonder if you just take the Border bit out, what do you think happens with cricket at that point?
God, so the mid 80s, you took, like, who's captain for starters? Like, when Hughes resigns, Hughes Boone? Is still going to resign. Sorry?
Boone?
Mate, Boone was still
he was young, wasn't he?
At that point.
It's
really hard to think gone, of. Might have been a bowler. I don't know.
But the bowlers didn't play? Jeff Lawson might have captained?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, Lawson was captaining New South Wales a lot, so maybe they just say, all right, Lawson, you're it. Maybe, yeah. But either way, I think...
Greg Ritchie? Greg Ritchie?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Backcat and friends. So, yeah, they could have been even worse in the 80s, which seems impossible to think of. You can't imagine them winning the 87 World Cup without Border there captaining them, because I don't think Simpson would come in straight away, because I think Border just said, I don't want to be in charge of any of this or any of this, you know, menial tasks. So that's when Simpson came in. Whether another captain would have handed it over that quickly or would have struggled on, or whether they would have just turned over captains, you know, once a year because they all got thrashed by the West Indies, who came out every single summer, as far as I can recall. Maybe that's what would have happened. It would have just been a turnover of captains, and maybe like all the professionalism and coaches and stuff just gets pushed back to the early 90s. I mean, maybe you don't get a Warne or a, you know, maybe you don't get all these youngsters. Maybe they all get burnt out.
Well, that's what I was thinking of. Like, what Border really does is he protects that whole generation of players from, you know, outside of perhaps Dean Jones, who he couldn't, you know, obviously there were personality issues between the team and Dean Jones and everything else, but he kind of protects Steve Waugh, who didn't make any runs forever, right? You know, he, as you said, like his, I think Mark Taylor would have might have been better for Warne tactically, but I think you needed someone quite strong around Warne early on to, you know, keep him there. The whole Glenn McGrath thing. Do you remember this? When Glenn McGrath was picked, everyone said, well, he'll never be successful because he doesn't have an outswinger, right? Yeah.
And then he tried to bowl an outswinger.
Yeah, that he did try by. And then, but Border was quite strong on, no, he does what he does. And obviously McGrath said a similar thing after he tried to bowl the outswinger for a little while and it was terrible. So that's a few, you know, what would the Australian team have been like? I mean, I think if Border doesn't come in, this is going well into down the wormhole here, but there's a very big chance that there's a huge power issue between Mark Taylor and Dean Jones, because Dean Jones I think plays if Border's not there, because he would have slotted back into the middle order spot where Border was taking up that spot, and Dean Jones was not the greatest leader. I could say he's a Victoria cricket fan. And I think Mark Taylor would have struggled to deal with Dean Jones consistently in that point. So it would have been, and if you go back and, you know, Dino's no longer here to defend himself, but if you talk to any Victorian cricketer from the 90s, like that, the atmosphere of Victorian cricket was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. And that, I think that would have bled over into the Australian team, because you would have had Warne, you would have had Merv, you would have maybe even Paul Rifle, but the most important thing would have been Dino, and he would have been trying to, you know. So I think there's a whole alternate history of what could have happened in that period, and maybe in the end it doesn't matter, that maybe once Warne and McGrath get so good and Mark Taylor wins a bunch of tests, and maybe he just gets the captaincy earlier, as you were saying before, because Mark Taylor, I reckon he was delayed about 2 years coming into the side. When, do you remember Wayne Phillips?
There were quite a few opening options. I mean, they had Boone and Marsh for a while, and then they were trying to work out how to squeeze everybody in there. But that's, you know, that's why Dean Jones went. So if Border isn't there, then Dean Jones doesn't have to go. Like they can't afford to drop him at that point. He scores too many runs to be dropped in a weaker team. So it's a good thought experiment. Good Dr. Strange work.
Yeah. No, it's just something I was coming up with all the way through. What else do you sort of have about what other sort of thoughts did you have about Alan Border, and was there anything else that sort of spoke to you that maybe before you did the book you hadn't really come to your mind?
It's not really so much about Border. I was kind of intrigued. I knew that Warne hadn't won an Alan Border medal, and he is, you know, spoiler, he's the player of the 90s, which is useful because that meant I get to write about him as well. I think the research I did suggests that Warne was a big factor in kind of creating this thing, and you know, he loved Border, so he was like a massive proponent, and maybe he's a big point behind it, the actual naming of it. I wasn't able to determine why it was named after Border, but the fact that Warne was just like, yeah, no, we should have this celebration, and yeah, Warne was never short of an ego either, so. I'm sure it was just like, hey, we should be up on stage getting all these plaudits and awards. Look how good we are. Come on, tell us about it.
What were some of the, were there any other cricketers that through, you know, your research that, especially you said before, you know, you're not a historian in that kind of way. What were some of the cricketers, whether from modern times or from older times, that sort of you didn't know much about and this sort of changed your opinion of?
I think the 60s were an interesting era. Because the 60s ended up being, it was bad luck for Richie Benaud that he kind of straddled the end of the 50s and the beginning of the 60s, which meant he didn't actually qualify to win either one of them. So it ended up being Bill Laurie who actually won the 60s. So I wasn't quite aware of how dominant Bill Laurie was at his peak. You think of him as a commentator these days. It's just like, oh, Bill Laurie's that very excitable man who loves Victorians. But he was a bloody good cricketer as well. So I knew he was good. I didn't quite realise how good he was. So that was interesting.
As a cricket journalist, I would travel up to 200 days a year. And I loved every part of it, except for one. this little evil pin here because I needed this to change my SIM card. And when you travel in cricket, you're quite often going from country to country. Don't get me started on how much this would annoy me in the West Indies, but even going from New Zealand to Australia, this pin was the worst. Well, with the Sally eSIM, they sort all of that out for you. They have an eSIM app that you install once, it's cheap, and it works in more than 160 countries around the world. No more turning up at an airport and lining up for a local SIM, trying to give over your passport and your details, and you just want to get in a taxi and go where you're going. No, Sally make it so much easier. You just download the app before you travel and you decide what kind of plan you actually need. Oh, and if you do that with our code, GOODAREAS, all one word, you get an exclusive 15% discount on Sally eSIM data plans. So go right now and download the Sally app and use the code GOODAREAS, all one word, at checkout and travel like a pro with Sally. Well, it was funny. When I talked to Ian Chappell for the book, he was sort of saying that part of the reason that Bill Laurie has been talked down is the way that because of his relationship with Tony Gregg.
Right.
So, you know, the whole, you know, corpse with pads on, and defensive and everything. And you go through Bill Laurie's record and he was a defensive batter, but I don't think he was like defensive for his era, if that makes sense.
You know,
when we're not talking about one of those batters who had a strike rate of 28 or 29. And in fact, he was quite a good scorer. And what Ian Chappell said was he was brilliant to bat with because he was always looking for singles. So you were never off strike very long with Bill Laurie. So it wasn't, he wasn't like a boycott who was, I'm going to defend. Now there's a ball I can score off.
Yeah,
Bill was constantly looking for runs. I do think, if I'm not mistaken, Bill Laurie is one of those Australian cricketers who averaged, 56 at home and 39 away from home.
Yeah.
So he's exactly the sort of guy I was talking about before with one of those, the anti-border. But yeah, it's funny because our books sort of overlap because we're both doing a similar thing, except I'm looking at other cricketers. But it is another interesting one of, when I looked at it, Bob Simpson and Bill Laurie, Bob Simpson has a much better batting average overall. Yep. But when you start to break down everything, it's like no one considered Bob Simpson the better player. And he made some runs, some huge scores, like the 100 on a very flat wicket and everything else. Whereas Bill Laurie was considered the better player, but he has a bit of a drop-off at the end of his career because the captaincy completely erodes his mind.
Yeah.
And so, again, all those things matter to your legacy. Was there any other sort of older players that's a really good one, Bill Laurie, because people just don't remember him as a great bat, and he clearly was.
Yeah. Not so much an older one. One of the things I found kind of quirky about, like, in the actual era of the Allan Border medal was how David Warner won as many as he did, but it's kind of a quirk of the mechanism of how it works. So it's 3-2-1 for the best players, but that meant he won in a year where Australia won the 2020 award for performances in 2019, despite being absolutely rubbish during the 2019 Ashes, because you don't get points taken off you for being terrible, you just get points when you're really good. So as good as Steve Smith was that summer, David Warner was just as good in the World Cup that year, and good enough in the Australian summer that followed, that all his rubbishness during the Ashes in 2019 didn't count. That didn't take any points off. And sorry, Steve Smith. So there's a lot of times where you look at it and you go, surely Steve Smith, who's averaged 90, 80, some ridiculous number in Test cricket, surely he wins. No, it's David Warner who's averaged some lower amount but has had these incredible peaks to go alongside these equally incredible troughs.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because I never thought about it. Because of the sort of Brownlow, Daly M style of voting system, that it doesn't really look for the player who is the best player. It's a little bit more slanted towards were you a really good player consistently over a long period of time, rather than, let's say Fraser McGurk this year makes two double hundreds in ODI cricket and, 100, a couple of 150s in T20 cricket, and then makes his test debut and makes 100. He's not more likely to win it than Josh Hazlewood is for regularly taking 2, 3, and 4 wicket hauls.
As long as Josh Hazlewood is getting 2 and 1 points, he's fine. But if Josh Hazlewood is like the fourth or fifth best, then he's in trouble. So it's really interesting. You've got to be in the top three every game for that to apply. Or you
But
can
you know
do
what I
one.
Mean? Because you can get a bunch of 3 votes, right? Yes. For being very good. But it's not like, so let's say, okay, let's take it a step further. Let's say Fraser McGurk made a 300 in an ODI game for Australia, right? He still only gets three votes. Yeah, he still only gets three votes, whereas Aaron Hardy takes four and two of those wickets are in the at the tail, and he might get three votes in a loss. So I'd never really, until you said it, but because I was brought up to believe that this is the greatest system of all time because of Aussie rules football, and only now am I looking at it going, wait a minute, that's not how the other major event awards in other sports work, right? Like if you were to put together, you know, so Mitchell Johnson, I'm assuming in 2013-14 did pretty well because of what happened. But if all of his performances were in those games, and then outside of those games, he was just an ordinary cricketer who didn't pick up any votes, someone else could steal that award from him. So is David Warner the best case? Has there been another one where someone else has kind of done that as well?
I think Warner was the one that really stood out to me as like, wait a sec, Smith was so good this year. How can it not be Smith? And it's just like, no, it's Warner. And it's just kind of, and because I went back and I looked at all the newspaper articles at the time, it's just like, all the newspaper articles are furious. It's like, it's, you know, Stuart Broad is doing, you know, congratulations, David Warner, lol tweets. David Warner is the clearest example of that one. There was also an example in the very early days. Colin Miller was the test player of the year on countback alongside, you know, everybody got 2 points. You know, everybody got two threes or three twos throughout the summer or the year. And it ended up, you know, four or five of them all tied. And then there was a convoluted countback system. And yeah, all right, Colin Miller's the best test player amongst this team of champions. Why not? Let's go with that.
He wasn't even always in the side, was he? I mean, that was really early on in the Alan Border, you know, night and everything. And we're all like, wait, what? I mean, I think it's great that a role player can come through and do something like that. But it's also, it was a pretty strong team, Dad. Like, I think, I kind of feel that someone else could have done it. Yeah, you know. I think that's interesting. How would you change the voting if you – because I was thinking then that the other way of doing this is you give 10 votes per game and then one player can get eight and another one can get two. But you can also have situations where you might – also say, no, we're not giving out the full votes for this game. You know, we got bowled out for 48 in an ODI and they beat it. Like, it's like one person gets one vote for making 12.
Maybe just going with what you're saying there. If you win, you get 30 points to divvy up. If you draw or tie or no result, you get 20 points to divvy up. If you lose, you get 10 points to divvy up. And maybe that's how you do it. Just for comical purposes, I would love to have the players voting on -3, -2, and -1 for their three worst teammates in every match. That would make me very happy, especially if they put up on the board who got the votes. That would be perfect.
Would you change who does the voting?
I think it's fine to have teammates vote on it. So it's teammates and then press and umpires. It's a bit hazy exactly how it's all combined together. Yeah. I did try to research this. It's all incredibly vague. It mostly seems to give pretty decent results. I'm fine with it.
Because we mentioned Twitter the Brownlow before. Yeah.
Blue sky vote.
Because we mentioned the Brownlow before. You know, there's been some incredible moments in the Brownlow in Aussie Rules football when weird things have happened. There was a player called Shane Woden who won the Brownlow in, it must have been late 90s, early 2000s, around the time the Alan Border was probably coming about. And he had bleached blonde hair. And there was a theory that if you had a really, really full-on hair style, the umpires would notice you more because it would stick out. And on top of that, I think he and another player might have both had bleached blonde hair. And the thought process was that the umpires had kind of just combined them into one player. Yeah, and the guy who was down with the guy who was down on the ground doing all the naughty work, you couldn't see his face because his head was down, but the blonde hair was there. And then the other guy was quite stylish out on the wings, kicking the ball beautifully down the field. It's my point B is it's not a perfect system, but as someone who like follows the NBA and watches some of the voting, there was a guy a couple of years ago who did his NBA voting and just forgot a player.
Yeah.
Right. And it was like a major commentator. It wasn't like some beat reporter from Phoenix or something, right? It was like, and like afterwards, everyone had to say to him, you didn't put this player in. He goes, no, 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 he's there. And they're like, no, he's not. He didn't give him a vote. So there is no perfect system. But I'm with you. I think there's something very Australian cricket about the fact that the players have the biggest vote. Because that's kind of why I've always thought what distinguishes Australian cricket is we probably look more at what you've done for the team rather than what your individual stats are. So there's an element of that. At the end of this book, did you love the Alan Border medal more? Do you never want to watch another Alan Border medal? Where are you with this emotionally?
I think my policy on watching the actual ceremony itself will continue to be the same. It's just like, well, I'll wait for clips to come out on whatever social media platform I happen to be on, and maybe I'll click through on any that get enough retweets that suggest that it's amusing. Otherwise, I'll just, you know, read who won. The actual award itself, it's fine. More often than not, it goes to the right person. So I'm happy with that. And I haven't really mentioned yet that obviously I'm writing about the women as well. So there's lots of, the Belinda Clark Award.
You talked about Betty Wilson before, and you talked about Belinda Clark. So how many Belinda Clarks would Belinda Clark have won if Belinda Clark could Belinda Clark?
She would have won not as many as you thought, because Karen Rolton kept hogging all the stuff in that kind of era. And Karen Rolton actually went on to win, you know, I think it was the first four Belinda Clark Awards. Like, she was an unstoppable creature around the turn of the century there. And then, of course, you know, you get into I kind of like the symmetry of it begins with, you know, this great men's team of the turn of the century, a great men's Australian team. And then there's kind of this lull. And then all of a sudden, this great kind of women's Australian team emerges. Yeah. And that kind of drives, because there is no mention of women at all for like the first decade or so of coverage. Like, technically, they're winning medals. No one cares about it. Like, no one mentions it. And then slowly but surely, it's really fascinating to go through the old newspaper articles. Just like, oh, someone's talking about more than just, you know, one, oh, didn't whoever, Elise Perry look lovely in that gown last night? It's just like, no. They start talking about the cricket, and then it's more and more. And then, yeah, you get to today where it's pretty much as close as equal as you can get.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, because I was in Australia. I think of the Alan Border night, the whole thing as a men's event, because I moved to the UK in 2008. And at that stage, there was a junior award and there was a women's award, but it was like, it was very much like, you know, best special effects makeup at the Oscars, wasn't it? It was almost over the road, pre-recorded beforehand type of thing. And so I don't even think of it. I mean, I don't think of the Alan Border medal very much. I've thought more about the Alan Border medal today than I have probably for the last decade and a half combined, right? Like, it just... Yep. You know, apologies to Cricket Australia, who's still trying to make it a thing, but it hasn't worked for me. You know, being away from it and not having it just pop up on the TV. But it is really interesting that it has become something else. And I suppose having a star specifically like Elise Perry, and then the entire team that follows her as well, it would be silly now if it was, you know, if you, as you said, in the Shane, by the time we got to the Shane Watson years and the women's team is becoming the best team in the world, it would be kind of ridiculous to be going on about Shane Watson while Elise Perry is sitting beside him.
Yeah. And it starts to pick up around that stage. And I think it really kicks into gear when, in the Sandpaper Gate year, where it's just like, oh God, everyone hates these men. Bloody hell, those women are looking pretty good, aren't they? Don't they win everything? Let's pay more attention to them. That may be too cynical, but that's certainly the vibe I got from, let's really bump up the profile on this now.
Yep. How far back did you go with the women? Like,
I went all the way back to the
1930s?
Yep. When, very, very little data. So there are women winning based on a single test in a single year. It's just like, fine, you get it. You're the best player.
Who won in the 1980s? Do you remember?
1980s. Oh, God. I can't tell you off the top of my head. I'm sorry. Sorry.
No, because, you know, there's a really controversial Australian women's player called, I think her name, is it Denise Annetts?
Yes. I recognize that name, yes.
Yeah, so she averages in Test cricket. So I'm just trying to bring it up now because it's a ridiculous amount when I tell you. She averaged 81.9 and was dropped from the Australian team, and then claimed that she was dropped because she was straight and not gay.
That's right. Yeah, I remember that.
And I wondered if you had to give her the Belinda Clark medal. Because that, of course, you did?
Yeah, she's definitely in the table in there. I remember that name. I recognize that name. She's in there.
There we go.
I didn't write a full piece on her, but she's in there. She's in a table in the book.
She's in my book as well. There really isn't a lot of information about her, and most of the information is about the allegation.
Yeah.
Women's cricket, just as you said before, you said there was no stats. There's very little coverage of the games as well. Like there's, you know, in because I think in England there's so many newspapers. There's, you know, little agency copies that you can go through, and, you know, Hypercourse is more of an expert than you and I are on those sorts of things. But when you go to women's cricket and you try and go back and look at the old players, sometimes you don't get anything at all on any of these players, and you don't know much. And so she's, as I said, someone who plays 10 test matches, which for women's cricket is not, well, modern women's cricket is not a small amount. But even in the history of, I think the most is probably 25 to 35, right? Like there's a few players around that period. So she played a decent amount, but there isn't a lot on her as a player. But there is a lot on her and this controversy.
It was very fascinating. I specifically had a section in my book where I tracked each year like how much coverage there was of the women's cricket and how it was changing over time. And that was one of the more, you know, because I'm no saint. I was as oblivious about women's cricket as most men, I think, in, you know, when the Alan Border medal started. And
when we were watching cricket, it wasn't on TV and it wasn't on radio and the newspapers wouldn't cover it. So if you think of the Australian women's cricket, we had the World Cup win in the 90s was quite big when they won at Eden Gardens. I remember that getting a lot of press. Zoe Goss getting Brian Lara out in the cricket game. Belinda Clark and Karen Rolton being stars was mentioned. Like you would hear that. And Catherine Fitzpatrick was a big deal because she was the fastest woman in the world. Yes. And I remember her, I don't know the guy's name, but he works with Tony Martin, Ed something, the comedian. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I could be wrong with this. You might be able to write a whole essay on this one time. I'm pretty sure he faced Catherine Fitzpatrick because he could play cricket. I think he's the comedian who did. And Catherine Fitzpatrick bounced him, and he suddenly realized, oh shit, no, she's legit. This is not what I was expecting to face. And it was a really interesting one because that was right at the start of that period. So when do you notice the media start to cover it in Australia, women's cricket, compared to before?
It's really in that, you know, that 2013-14 era. Like it's basically when, you know, your Healy's, when your Lannings, your Perry's are all just like, all right, here we go. We're not going to be stopped anymore. And it's just like, okay, fine. We'll pay attention to you.
I remember, and it must be just before that, when Rebel Sport did a whole thing, and I forget the woman's name, I'm really sorry, but Michael Clark's wife, is it Kylie
Clark? Kylie,
Yeah. I remember Kylie there was a huge... Clark. Yeah, they did a huge thing. Yeah, let's hope that she hasn't changed today. I remember her next to the white horse, no, her on the white horse with Michael Clark. Like, I remember some details about Kylie Clark, so, you know, got to give me some credits there, if her name is Kylie and it's not somebody else, but... She
I think
got
it's
a
K-Y-L-Y
deal.
As well.
It is. I don't know if you could see it. It was in my eyes, but I didn't want to get into that because I think I read about 10 columns on the spelling. But she got a deal with Rebel Sport, I want to say, around that whole 2012 to 2014-15 period. I can't remember exactly when it was. And I remember for the first time a lot of people going, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Like she's got a deal with Rebel Sport to, you know, be the face of their, you know, fitness stuff. And Elise Perry doesn't have a deal with anyone. And that's the period when I remember it. And, you know, I'd already moved over to Australia, to England by that stage. So I'd moved out of it. But that's the period that I remember the coverage of it all changing and everything else. So, as you said before, that 2013-2014 period, it's when the team becomes professional as well. It's very hard to cover an amateur team, you know, that is sporadically touring, that is quite often going to other countries where no one is covering their matches as well. Yeah. Like, I understand that there was certainly a huge amount of misogyny and ignorance and everything else. But even if you love women's cricket, it was not particularly easy to follow in the 90s. Yeah. Like I was helping coaching women's cricket in the 90s and I was interested in those players. And unless Belinda Clark made 200 in an ODI game, I probably wasn't going to be hearing anything about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a completely different era. I found it fascinating how close it is and yet so how alien it is to the modern coverage. It's fascinating.
If you do, We said that the Alan Border one was an interesting name. How are you about the Belinda Clark? Because again, star player, but more famous for really what she represents as much as anything else.
Yeah, I think she's slightly different to Alan Border. I think she's the one kind of pioneering the professionalism, like not actual professionalism in terms of money, but professionalism in terms of mindset in the 90s. So I think that's kind of her legacy. What would have happened if she wasn't there? God only knows. Maybe Karen Rolton steps up and says, I'm just as professional as you. Maybe nothing changes that much. It is interesting to think about.
Yeah, because it's funny that those are the two cricketers we've picked, and they are both hugely important on the future of cricket. But like, I don't think Belinda Clark in 10 or 15 years' time will be talking about her as a batter or a leader as much because, she's already sort of slipping. Yeah, and yet in some ways Belinda Clark's maybe even more important than someone like Alan Border because she's the person who sort of crosses over between men's and women's cricket in that she ends up, being very important to the men's team as well and to all the cricketers. Your book is called Australian Cricket's Best of the Best, the outrageous unofficial, and then I forgot to ask you the rest of the title. Put it up on the screen.
The outrageous have you got it in unofficial front of you? History of the Alan Border medal. You will be outraged. Outraged. That's what it is. Smiling Pat Cummins on the cover.
How many Alan Border medals has he won?
Pat's won a single Alan Border medal. He sensibly did it in the year when Warner and Smith were both out. So it's like, all right, I'll jump in here and take that one. Thanks.
Feels like you've just put him on as some sort of woke agenda for your book rather than him being. I would have liked it if you just put Pat Cummins' body, and just stuck Alan Border's face over the front of it.
I'll let my grumpy face. Know.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Darren.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minbo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minbo.pro now.